Streaming by me on either side, British performers, writers, directors, producers, musicians, agents couldn't wait to get to the US, to New York, or better, LA, hungry for its wealth and potential for self-extension, if possible, the ultimate self-extension of stardom. So I was swimming against the tide. So what? They could have New York and LA. I wanted the UK. I had not been this up about a project since I joined the Lampoon. Rog and Pete were two of my closest friends, and easily the funniest. They thought I was brilliant. Lloyd had the Midas touch. A down-and-dirty pilot we'd done had floored everybody who'd seen it. This was the one. A TV show you wouldn't have to apologize for behind its back. On the contrary, the funniest, hardest-hitting TV show ever produced. Same mistake, over and over.
You remember, dear, when you used to come a few years ago and you'd tell me all the wonderful things you were doing in America?
Fondly. I lived for those walks.
And once, as you talked, I think it may have been the last time you came. My memory isn't what it was. There were such a lot of things you were doing. There was a film in France, I think, and a new magazine, and a book about the 80s, before they happened.
I'd thought my chatter had been just white noise, and he'd taken in every word.
You were very blasé about it all. I remember thinking, what a shame he isn't enjoying it more. I hope he hasn't lost his soul.
I'm not sure any more that I have a soul.
Even an atheist can lose his soul, dear.
Funny you're bringing that up. Last night, after our walk, I began to, well, examine my conscience. It was your two kinds of people theory that set me off.
Which kind are you, do you think?
I do tend to think in black and white, even though I know there are 100 shades of grey. I've trained myself in paths of thought, ruts might be a better word, that reflexively denigrate certain people. People I don't agree with or have contempt for or whose motives I suspect. I must admit I haven't considered for years what effect that might have on my own moral state.
It can hardly be a good effect, can it, dear?
No. But most people I know have the same reflexes. Editors, journalists, writers, TV and movie people. We all share pretty much the same assumptions. They're considered morally neutral. They're how you generate material. Some journalists would say that suspicion and skepticism are professional obligations.
Is anything morally neutral, Tony dear? Suspicion, skepticism, contempt? They don't sound like virtues.
No one uses words like virtue anymore, Father Joe.
But these attitudes must have the potential to hurt, no?
Yes, but with the likes of Reagan and Thatcher running the show, there are things we need to fight for. Defend the Bill of Rights, stand up for minorities, try to stop the military from murdering quite so many people.
Do you and your friends succeed?
We're not chalking up a lot of wins right now.
Then why do you continue?
I thought about this. A simple enough question. But when had I ever asked myself, why did we continue? Were my friends, or was I, really defending anything? Bernstein said the Lampoon helped bring down Nixon. Of course, it was really him and Woodward. But what had been their ultimate purpose? To put Woodward and Bernstein in the White House and do a better job? No. To put Woodward and Bernstein on the map. Secretly, we were sort of happy with the status quo, so long as we got a piece of it. The truth is, Father Joe, what we really do it for is attention. We all jostle endlessly to be on talk shows, get items in the columns, or columns in the papers, or books on the bestseller list, or green lights for our pilots and our movies to... how did you used to put it? To extend ourselves out into other people's awareness. He considered this, looking out at the Solent.
Needing attention is a powerful force in the world, isn't it?
Absolutely. Most people would think of it as a very natural need, almost a right.
By natural, you mean morally neutral.
Touché.
Without God, people find it very hard to know who they are or why they exist. But if others pay attention to them, praise them, write about them, discuss them, they think they've found the answer to both questions.
If they don't believe in God, you can't blame them.
True, dear. But it still makes for an empty, unhappy person. I'm sure Mrs. Thatcher wasn't always the way she is. As she came to power and got more and more attention, she began to be more and more what people wanted her to be. But that's not the true Mrs. Thatcher. The Mrs. Thatcher God wants her to be.
I'm not sure Mrs. Thatcher would see the distinction you do between herself and God. At least I got a smile out of him. Are you saying, Father Joe, that in the matter of motives, or even morally, there's not ultimately much difference between me and my targets?
I'm afraid not, dear. If the result is that you only have a personality other people shape, if you really exist only in other people's minds.
I think you've just described celebrity.
I've just described pride, dear.
The show went into production in the fall of 83 amid great media excitement, a lot of overhyped press, and rumblings from Maggie's mastodons. We'd made no secret of our intentions. Rog and Pete, and Rog's wife Deirdre, were quite visible in left-wing activist circles. My track record was hardly Reagan-o-Thatcherite, and Denton's sympathies were well known. We'd also acquired a hard-driving executive producer, John Blair, a South African exile with impeccable leftist credentials. He'd produced the first documentary on the Soweto uprisings. Blair and I hated one another on sight. He quickly made it clear to the other principals that he thought there were too many captains on the bridge. As the great actor Edward Kean said on his deathbed, "Life is easy, comedy series are hard." Spitting Image had the added burden of being topical, making scripts hard to stockpile, and the actors were both actors and puppeteers, holding over their bodies 3 to 5 foot tall puppets, whose actions they could only track on TV monitors, and who were based on living people whose voices had to be mimicked well enough to be funny, usually by an off-camera impressionist who had to lip-sync to the puppet's mouth movements. No one had ever attempted a show this demanding. I insisted that the three originals, Rog, Pete, and I, keep script control. It was the only way we could guarantee that the show would not go television. That meant me, as Rog and Pete had their work cut out molding rubber oligarchs. Lloyd was responsible for everything between script and final airtape. Rehearsal, the studio, the edit suite. Plus, it was his ass on stage, his golden boy reputation at stake. To make script production easier, I developed several mini-sitcoms, segments with more or less the same characters each week. Ron and Nancy and Ed Meese would appear in "The President's Brain is Missing," Reagan's walnut-sized brain having escaped from his head and gone on the lam. Number 9 Downing Street had Maggie's next-door neighbor, a silver-haired 80-something German gentleman named Wilkins, clearly Hitler in retirement, giving her political advice over the garden fence. A third was Exchequers, a retirement home for doddering ex-prime ministers like Wilson, Macmillan, Callaghan, and Alec Douglas Hume. Lloyd hated these. They were too political and too long. He preferred quick sketches and lots of laugh-in-like jokes, the shorter the better, and plenty of them, so that he could discard the ones he didn't like on the studio floor.
Are you happy doing what you do, dear?
It was the third day. His hip was acting up, so we were sitting in the garden. He had taken my hand in his, resting them on the wooden bench between us. Let's see, I'm happy at the beginning of a project and at the end, but rarely in between. I suppose I'm happy when things succeed, though however successful they are, it never seems to be enough. I'm happy when I'm writing, if it's something funny.
Is it the writing, or that it's funny?
Writing by myself rather scares me. I suppose that it's funny.
So, being funny, Tony dear, having people laugh at you all the time, or at what you write, makes you happy?
Yes, but I worry a bit when I see what often happens to funny people. You'd think that constantly making people laugh, being around laughter all the time, would have a very positive effect on a person, right? But quite the opposite seems to be the case. Perhaps it's constantly looking for the failings in people to get a laugh out of them. I told him a story about Jerry Lewis. Years before, my partner Nick and I had been on Jerry's telethon. I was waiting to go on, standing beside Jerry off camera. It was 20-odd hours into the show, and mine host was well into his nth bottle of the good stuff. One of Jerry's kids was on camera, a severely disabled young teen who was desperately trying to pick out a solo on his guitar. The noise was excruciating. Jerry had turned to the floor manager and snarled, "Get that fucking cripple off stage!" At this punchline, Father Joe flinched as if someone was about to hit him. Sorry about the language.
No, no, it's not that. Did the poor boy hear him?
Luckily, he was making too much noise.
Perhaps it was just a momentary lapse, because Jerry Lewis was so tired.
Maybe. To tell the truth, I've never met a funny man or funny woman who wasn't crazy, unhappy, vindictive, untrustworthy, screwed up, and that's just the normal ones. I had another example for him, Jackie Mason, the man who'd found me and Nick in the Blue Angel in London, who invited us to America, got his manager, Bob Chartoff, to manage us, and sponsored us for green cards. Before he became a comedian, he'd been a rabbi in training, not unlike me, bred in many of the same traditions. After 25 years of probing other people's failings, he had orange hair, wore a corset, and had an endless string of girlfriends. Jackie's funny as hell, but happy? Or more to the point, good? As good as when he was a young ex-rabbi? I don't know. Would he still help two young men come to America?
Do you think you're becoming a Jerry Lewis or Jackie Mason, dear?
Was I? Would I end up with orange hair and a corset and my own pet disease? Was I already halfway there? I was one of the craziest, unhappiest, most vindictive, least trustworthy people I knew. Yikes. Pre-production started in the fall of 83. Immediately, tensions began to build. Lloyd, backed by Blair, demanded final cut on the scripts. I refused. He loaded up Rog and Pete with dozens of new puppets, over and above obvious figures like the Royals, Thatcher and her cabinet, etc. Almost all of them inane British TV personalities. Ominous. With these puppets, we'd end up doing TV about TV. Precisely the kind of comedy we wanted to put in its grave. What could make things more tense? Ah, yes. Cut costs by transporting the entire show by rail each week to Birmingham, armpit of England, compounding its massive logistical design and performance problems, driving everyone to a fever pitch of fear and insomnia. Blair flourished in this atmosphere and began promoting the notion that Hendra's scripts were the root cause of all the chaos. Things shot from bad to worse to appalling at warp speed. Never in my experience of American TV, or The Lampoon, or any other U.S. enterprise, had I come across the level of viciousness these Brits displayed in their infighting. The archetype of unflappable Britishness had disappeared with unscarred countryside and gnarled old cockneys. No one seemed to have heard of stiff upper lips. Frothing fits, screaming fits, cursing which you needed a medical degree to understand, echoed down the corridors till dawn. I'd been struck before by how crazy Brits were for their TV. Not surprising, really, if you're watching the best in the world. Whereas Americans became slack-jawed and narcotized by TV, as if it were a giant, light-emitting quaalude, Brits became jumpy and hysterical, as if it were bombarding them with neutron-sized hits of crystal meth. Now, I wondered if this hysteria was somehow endemic to the British version of the medium, since it was the order of the day on the production side as well.
I remember long ago, when you saw that show in Cambridge, you wrote a wonderful letter about it. You remember everything. How can there be any space left in there after 75 years? In your letter, you said laughter was holy and capable of changing the world.
We were rounding Caw's Great Farm from the other direction than our accustomed one. It was less steep this way, and he was moving a little slowly. In the early 80s, he'd developed asthma, and he had to stop once in a while. There were whispers at Caw that it was psychosomatic. In 1964, the last French abbot had resigned, and there had been an election in which the only viable candidates were Father Joe and Dom Aylred. Dom Aylred had won, and made Father Joe his prior or second in command. The head and the heart, the holy odd couple, worked well until, rather abruptly in 1980, the abbot demoted Father Joe to sub-prior. The excuse was that the monastery needed younger, newer blood. That was when the asthma started. Joe told me none of this, of course. As far as he was concerned, the situation was sweet. Fewer duties and his newfound disease meant he could pop off occasionally to balmier climes, France, and best of all, Italy. His current wheezing suggested it was time to call the travel agent.
Dear, oh dear, I shouldn't be flagging. I don't think I'm going to make old bones, I'm afraid.
Don't say that, Joe. I'll tell you when you can die. It won't be any time soon.
I think you're quite right to think of laughter as holy, Tony dear. And I don't mean just at holy things. Laughter's a kind of safety valve, isn't it? It's very good in chapter, when a man's being really tiresome or far too serious, and someone else just can't stop themselves giggling. Oh, I like that. I join right in.
What I loved about you when we first met, Father Joe, was that you were the only priest who'd ever made me laugh.
Well, there you are, and I hope I always shall. We should laugh at priests much more often. When you think about it, laughter's a very important thing. Life is full of little pretenses and pretensions, and when we laugh at them, we get at the truth behind them for a moment. That's very good for all concerned, I think.
I remembered the time, long ago, when I was almost one of them, that, yes, they did. They laughed and smiled and joked and played pranks. Apparently, even in the greater silence, they found ways to crack each other up.
We don't think of God laughing, do we? Yet if God is happiness, God must be laughter, too. Do you remember that wonderful passage of Meister Eckhart you found once?
For the life of me, I couldn't remember who this German guy was. It was 25-plus years ago. Yet Father Joe had it verbatim.
When God laughs at the soul, and the soul laughs back at God, the persons of the Trinity are begotten. When the Father laughs at the Son, and the Son laughs back at the Father, that laughter gives pleasure, that pleasure gives joy, that joy gives love, and that love is the Holy Spirit.
The first air date approached. The frenzy, panic, cursing, fear, frothing, loathing, and throwing of fits reached unscalable heights. This was comedy? I spent most of my time and energy trying to calm people down. Forget it. No one wanted to be calmed down. The show went on the air. The puppets were lumbering, badly blocked, woodenly shot. Editing appeared to have been done by a blind amputee. The mini-sitcoms dragged. The sound was awful. The reviews were execrable. There were questions in the House of Commons. The royalists were furious at a segment in which the Queen made fun of Thatcher's sleazy pretensions. The piece clearly took the inbred old parasite's side against the rabid grocer's daughter. No matter. They objected to reducing the head royal to rubber. But all the signs were there. We had the potential for a huge hit. The puppets were a new dimension in the medium. You couldn't take your eyes off them. They were intrinsically hilarious. They didn't need week-to-week building up, as most series characters do. They were instantly recognizable news figures. Best of all, they made the right people furious. We only had to make them move better, write shorter lines, establish relationships between them, and Spitting Image would take off like a cruise missile. It might take a month or three, but we were sitting on a revolution in TV satire. John Cleese wrote me a note that night, saying how brilliant he thought Whatever Your Show Is Called was. He found some of the puppets and voices weak, but the scripts were strong. He particularly liked the mini-sitcom, Exchequers. I took his note with me the morning after the premiere to show to my colleagues. When I got there, I didn't bother. The level of frenzy, panic, fear, and loathing had achieved the impossible. It had increased. No one seemed to have seen, or to have the slightest confidence in, the TV breakthrough that had occurred the night before. At this point, I knew I was not long for this loony bin. The end game began.
Have you changed the world at all, dear?
No, Father Joe, not one tiny bit. There were a couple of occasions in the late 70s, at least I think it was a couple, and I think it was the late 70s, that dawn moment when the euphoria is as distant a memory as the coke, and you know you're not going to sleep till noon, when the rising sun strikes across Upper Manhattan from the east side to the west, turning the ziggurats of New Jersey into fiery bronze, and Ur of the Chaldees lives again in Weehawken. But all this sublime urban vision does is depress you further. Then I'd call him. It would be lunchtime at Core, so he could talk a while, which he did in the wary, over-polite manner monks have on the phone. I, who had been up all night in fast and furious coke monologue, listening to no one and making everyone listen to me, would just slouch there, silent, as he hurried and stuttered on, burbling away with news of the monastery, interpolating, "Are you still there, dear?" and dropping a few gems of loving wisdom. The post-coke shame would fade, and I would have a brief fantasy of faith and hope. Someday soon, I'm going back, and my faith will make me whole, and I will finally, finally be a monk.
The world is hard to change, Tony dear.
I thought we were having some effect once, but no. The dogs of war are back in charge. The poor are being told poverty is their own fault. The free market rules.
Whatever is the free market? A market where everything's free?
Au contraire. In a few pithy words, I explained the gist of Reaganomics.
Let me see if I understand. What it boils down to is, my self-interest is in your interest.
That's pretty much it.
Sounds like poppycock.
We were rounding back up to the monastery, having taken a shortcut through the garden. He was leaning heavily on my arm by now.
Work is so important, isn't it, dear? Work works in unknown ways. If work is done well, conscientiously, joyfully, I think it has an effect far beyond what's actually made or grown or sold.
Laborare est orare.
Very good. You do remember.
I thought that only applied to monk work.
I don't see why. Laborare est orare doesn't mean we actually mumble prayers while we work, does it? You drive the other chaps balmy. The work itself is prayer. Work done as well as possible. Work done for others first and yourself second. Work you are thankful for. Work you enjoy that uplifts you. Work that celebrates existence, whether it's growing grain in the fields or using God-given skills like yours. All this is prayer that binds us together and therefore to God.
My work is prayer?
Why is the work you've chosen less valuable than mucking out the cows?
He nodded toward a monk who was hosing out the cattle pens. I guess I muck out sacred cows. Finally, I got a real laugh. I thought about work as prayer. Driving a truck? Logging a forest? Slinging hash? Selling cars? Teaching school? Working as a GS-12 or in the IRS or the DMV or a fire department? All this, done joyfully, thankfully, unselfishly, conscientiously, becomes prayer? Why not? Not in the pious sense of nice, polite requests floating up to a capricious godhead. Rather, a force, vital and alive, part of the quotidian fabric, producing at a depth unknown to pollsters, spin doctors, demographers, and other calibrators of human emotion, widespread outcomes throughout society. Innumerable small acts of generosity and goodwill, binding us closer, motivating us, giving us little boosts of hope and faith in each other. Changing the world, even. Why not indeed? For a man who didn't see the everyday world as separate from the sacred, who saw God everywhere, shining out from the down-to-earth and battered and untidy and defeated, who was a common-sense saint, a saint of what could be done, not should be done, a practical saint, a saint of imperfection. How I exited Spitting Image doesn't matter much. There was a lot of red in tooth and claw politics and supremely unfunny hand-to-hand combat. With the completion of the first series, 6 shows in the UK, I resigned. Lloyd got his script control and turned the show toward more harmless, quick-fire material. A lot of it TV about TV. Several of my contributions survived, notably the adventures of Reagan's tiny brain and a long-running segment with Thatcher terrorizing her obsequious cabinet. Despite the appalling script job I'd supposedly done, the first season series was nominated for a British Academy Award, which in the UK are given for TV as well as films. It didn't win that year, but it did the next. Dear old England, land of the creatively fairly free, and home of the artistically quite brave. Spitting Image was a massive hit in the UK. It ran on ITV for 10 years, making many reputations and clinching Lloyd's. It was widely imitated elsewhere in Europe, and its clones are still running there. It continues to make the right people furious. The Canal Plus version is an enduring factor in French politics, including the seismic French elections of 2002. Vladimir Putin imprisoned the producer of the Russian version. The day I resigned was one of the worst of my life. My dreams of return, the modest but prestigious success of the series establishing me in the smart, tasteful milieu of British popular culture, securing my place as a bona fide member of the 60s humour generation, the thatched cottage in the West Country with the paddock and orchard, and pair of green wellies by the wisteria-choked back door, The English Rose girlfriend, or 3 or 10, one morphing eventually into a second wife. The Land Rover, or 2. The Sun, or 2. The getaway place in Tuscany with the 10th-century cellar for the wine. The thoughtful but irreverent columns in the Observer. History. Down the tube. How about atheists? If they work in the spirit that you're describing, would that be prayer?
Of course. God loves atheists as much as he does believers. Probably more.
Comforting for us atheists.
What you must ask yourself, Tony dear, is this. Do you do the work you've chosen with joy and gratitude? Do you do it conscientiously? Do you do it for others first and yourself second?
The questions hit me like a flurry of hooks to the solar plexus. He could not have known how on target he was. The ferocious, unfunny fight I'd just put up, standing like some fundamentalist preacher at the church door against the forces of levity and triviality. My argument with Lloyd being, at the end of the day, that long, tendentious jokes were politically and morally superior to short, silly ones. Never in a quarter of a century of the work I'd chosen had I had so humorless a humor experience as during the last 6 months. How much of that was me? There'd been no joy, no gratitude, no uplift in my work. Conscientious wasn't even on the table. Others first? Forget it. Perhaps it was the string of disappointments after so many successes. Perhaps humor was more a creature of fashion than I believed, and the fashion had changed. Perhaps Father Joe's theory of prayer was correct, and whatever prayer's evil opposite is had come back to bite me. I had arrived at the end of one phase of my life. I hadn't known it when I came, but Father Joe had. With consummate skill, he'd led me step by step to the realization that I had become a rather unpleasant person, that it was time to move on to a second phase, but without rejecting, as I was prone to do, everything I'd so far accomplished. If he'd come out and said any one of those things, I would have bristled or resisted or just run away. Instead, he'd used his own code, prayer, God, and so on, and what he had to say was unerring. How do you do it, Father Joe?
Do what, dear?
You live inside a cloister, itself cloistered inside this pink and yellow pile. You have no driver's license. You have no TV. I assume you don't get out to the movies much. You live by a rule that was written a little under 1,500 years ago. Yet you have an uncanny ability to grasp the essentials of the most worldly things, in this case, what I do for a living. Have you been seeing other satirists?
You're the only one I know, dear.
Know what you are, Father Joe? You're an innocent savant. The next leap off the cliff had to be faced. I knew what it was. One I had been putting off and putting off. Because it scared the bejesus out of me. No more hiding behind editing and collaboration. I had to learn to be a writer. Over the next couple of years, I did write my first book. It was a history of American satire over the previous 30 years. Boomer humor, my editor made me call it, titled Going Too Far. Some was semi-autobiographical. I knew many of the people it covered, so it wasn't much of a cliff I plunged off. But it did force me to re-examine many preconceptions I had about laughter, satire, the whole business of being funny. The central discovery, which I couldn't avoid, given that I was reviewing some of the best comedy of the 20th century, an extraordinary generation of comic genii, was most unwelcome. While I worshipped laughter, and those who made it, on stage or page, I just wasn't that funny myself. I didn't possess the glorious madness that I loved in others. Lenny Bruce, Zero Mostel, S.J. Perelman, Mel Brooks, Peter Cook, Terry Southern, Peter Sellers and Spike Milligan, Jonathan Winters, John Cleese and Graham Chapman, George Carlin, Lily Tomlin, Richie Pryor, Michael O'Donoghue, Doug Kenny, John Belushi, Eddie Murphy, Gilda Radner, Dan Aykroyd. All had that ability to induce helpless hysteria in people. My theories of attack and changing minds would never produce more than appreciative chuckles. Great comics did attack sometimes, did direct laughter at targets. Cook at Macmillan, Lenny at racists, Pryor at Reagan, Carlin at the church. But even then, what you really laughed at was them. The madness within them. The openness to their own weirdness. A complete admission of their own surpassing imperfection. I had talent, perhaps, but I came to think of the word as an attempt to diminish the wild uniqueness of the truly funny, lumping them all together into one impersonal commodity. Talent was for the second string, a dim reflection of the real gift. A pathetic word when applied to the hard-edged, one and only presence, the haikitas of the true comic genius. That mysterious quality that you know the second the performer comes into view, which has you spluttering before she's said a word, before he's done anything. Then the demented god on the tongue, the delighted electricity rushing through the audience, the crack and rolling thunder of the laughter. We know it intimately, that quality, but no one has ever explained where it comes from, what it is, why you can't learn one iota of it even if you study it for a lifetime. For the truly funny, making people laugh is the highest form of humor. It comes first. Changing an audience's mind about something, my life's mission to date, comes a very distant second. A bitter moment, unearthing this truth, though I'd always known it not so deep down. Often, afterward, I wondered if somehow, in the vast reservoir of his intuition, Father Joe knew it too, and was gently trying to tell me, "Give it up, son, you're wasting your time." Truth has its comforts. If I had not found through him the wherewithal for this new conversion of life, had not written the book, I would never have arrived at that realization, might have gone on slogging away forever at changing the world through laughter. Talented guy, sort of funny. You believe that hair color? And why the corset? There were other compensations. To my surprise, the solitude of writing was sublime after so many years of collaboration. The arctic blankness of the page, which I'd so dreaded, melted like spring thaw. Writing was a new countryside to wander in, a new boyhood of discovery, a new green shade for new green thoughts. I got lost in it as I hadn't been able to in anything for 25 years. I owed this man all that. How could I ever have thought him irrelevant? We talked endlessly for the rest of that visit, spitting image already forgotten. We talked more about laughter, and we made each other laugh. I told him jokes that he actually got. Some he laughed at. We were speaking as equals, as friends, the way fathers and sons do when age begins to lessen the gap between them. I regretted the preceding years of first dependence, then distance, of obligatory love and grudging duty, that awful feeling of relief I'd had as I walked away from Core. But those feelings had been felt, and perhaps they'd had to be. Otherwise we would not be here. The day before I left, we went for our last walk. I was leaving early in the morning for Heathrow, where my girlfriend and I would fly to Crete and the ruins of 4,000-year-old cities. He asked me about her. "She's Italian, or rather Italian-American. Very beautiful." "Is she a blonde?" Again, the brightening of the eyes. "No, she's extremely smart." He still didn't get it.
"Are you going to marry her?"
"Never. Once is enough." As we came under the shadow of the monastery, something struck me. So simple, it made me laugh. The wonderful new English life I'd hoped Spitting Image would deliver to me was not just a fantasy, but a delusion. The reason I'd been so passionate about returning to England was the old man limping along by my side. Father Joe was my England. I didn't ever again want to be as far away from my little lighthouse as I had been on that night in Malibu. When we got up to the monastery, he let go of my arm and hauled himself over to a gallery-like area under one of the wings. Then, to my surprise, he began stomping up and down as briskly as he could, his big old Asterix sandals slapping on the cement.
"They told me to do this for 10 minutes each day to strengthen my hip."
I watched him slog back and forth. He did not look happy. "What you need is a marching song."
"Good idea. What do you have in mind, dear?"
"There's an old World War II song my dad taught me. First, the melody." I whistled the Colonel Bogey March. He picked it up right away, of course. "Okay, now here are the words. Hitler has only got one ball. Goering has two but very small." Father Joe laughed louder than I had ever heard him laugh.
"Himmler is somewhat similar, and poor old Goebbels got no balls at all."
Father Joe was bent double, helpless, slapping his knobbly knees with delight.
"Oh, my goodness! My turn to sing! Help me now!"
He began marching up the gallery, picking up the pace, straightening his 75-year-old back, bellowing at the top of his lungs.
"Hitler has only got one ball."
"Who?" "Goering."
"Goering has two but very small. Himmler is somewhat similar."
"That's my favourite part."
"And poor old Goebbels got no balls at all."
He sang the entire thing 6 more times at full volume. Chapter 15. Her name was Carla, and her Italian blood was immediately apparent. Dark, lustrous hair, castagna-brown eyes the size of golf balls, skin the color of young vino santo. I first saw her in the fall of 1981, across a crowded room of young neoconservatives from the University of Chicago. What was I doing in a group of young neoconservatives? Being hired. I work for the side that pays me the most. At the same time, I was also being paid by some anti-Shah, anti-Khomeini, but not pro-American Iranian exiles to edit and translate a tome called The Sayings of Ayatollah Khomeini. The UFC group was led by Peter Cohn, son of the legendary agent Sam Cohn. They'd decided that their postgraduate tribute to their amanuenses Milton and Rose Friedman would be a full-scale parody of the Wall Street Journal. Through Sam, who was my agent, I had been suggested as the editor of this enterprise. Carla was a graduate of UFC, Phi Beta Kappa, in fact, though not, happily, a neoconservative. She was strikingly beautiful and quite voluptuous. She'd worked as a model in L.A., but that night had a sullen, depressed demeanor, which I took to be boredom at the entrepreneurial prattle of her classmates. It turned out to be that and more, a defense mechanism protecting great insecurity, odd considering her intelligence and accomplishments, but which led people to underestimate her. This may have been why the role foreseen for her in the coming parody was General Dogsbody. She turned to me with a bored, heavy-lidded look, gave me the once-over, and smiled a conspiratorial little smile. I decided, then and there, that working for these Reaganite sprats might not be quite as obnoxious as it was beginning to sound. Of them, Cohn was by far the most aggressively neocon and monetarist. In fact, the whole enterprise, unlike the abysmally and unintentionally non-profit Not the New York Times, which was its model, was supposed to make money for its investors. It did, though not, as usual, for its creators. Cohn also had incoherent notions that it would somehow promote the life work of Uncle Milty and Auntie Rose. I had to explain at length and frequently that in that case he should have chosen a non-monetarist publication to parody. Hard to do a funny journal parody without being adversarial about the causes it championed and the pro-corporate policies of the administration it supported so enthusiastically. The fascinating thing about Cohn and his group was that they saw themselves as a new humor broom, an anti-lampoon swing of the pendulum. They dressed like, spoke like, and were proud to be preppies, arrayed against and contemptuous of permissive, hairy, peace-and-love loonies with no dress sense, like me. They were all, Carla included, 15 or so years my junior, and it was startling to be, for the first time, not the young insurgent, but the establishment fogey, who had to be dealt with for the moment because of his contacts and know-how, but would be swept away once these skills had been learned by the counter-revolution. More mundanely, Cohn and his group were rich kids. Cohn's fiancée, Carla's best friend, was the daughter of movie giant Eric Pleskow, the genius behind first United Artists and then Orion, a man with 14 Oscars in his dining room and the bucks to match. And, in a truly Shakespearean twist, Sam Cohn's sworn enemy. Carla wasn't a rich kid at all, and neither was I. This was our first bond, and making fun of the young masters, our second. She had a sharp, sour wit, and just as important, was a good audience. She also turned out to be a sensational manager, holding together all aspects of what became a mammoth job, 24 broadsheet pages with no paid advertising, every word and image of which had to be written, researched, photographed, and or retouched, copy-edited, typeset, changed at the last minute, paid for, printed down to the last agate stock listing and 5-point classified, and, of course, funny. She showed the first hints of a management style that would eventually make her a top-echelon executive, an ability to get things out of people under great stress, in a patient, non-confrontational way that didn't leave them bruised and resentful, as prevailing Darwinian corporate practices did. At the time, businesswomen tended to be either low-echelon drones or highly visible trapeze artists like Mary Cunningham. Carla was an early bird in a more solid and influential wave that would transform corporate management over the next two decades. What I did notice was that despite her beauty and obvious talents, she couldn't accept compliments. She would deflect them or make some self-deprecating rejoinder, or even challenge them as if unconvinced of their sincerity. Both this insecurity and her management skills may have been the result of growing up in the midst of an unusually large family. Catholic? Of course. The twist was that it was her German-Irish father, Mr. Meisner, who was the devout Catholic, not her all-Italian mother. Carla's mother was from the other end of Italy than the usual Neapolitan or Sicilian-American. Her family had deep roots in Piemonte, but she had been raised a Methodist. Like my father, she had agreed to raise her children as Catholics, and the result had been 17 pregnancies, 14 of them successful. So large a family was a kind of demographic subset in which could be found almost all the various tragedies, comedies, and tragicomedies that afflict modern American life. One boy had served in Vietnam. One girl had died senselessly in a mundane teenage car collision. One child had leukemia. Two were dedicated advocates of the downtrodden. One a public defender, the other an immigration attorney. One was a pediatrician, another a nurse. Two had been in the Air Force, not so much from militarism, but as a way to get a college degree at public expense. One graduating from the Air Force Academy, the other becoming an airline pilot. One worked on Wall Street, one was a professional concert violinist, one was becoming a big wheel in the California wine business. The only areas they hadn't got to so far were showbiz and the media. I could cover that. The more I got to know the Meisners and their growing number of spouses, The more it struck me that they weren't the usual stuff of American family-slash-dynasty stories. On the one hand, insufferably rich egomaniacs you're supposed to admire. On the other, impossibly saintly poor people who are supposed to inspire. They were neither particularly rich nor poor, neither obnoxious successes nor spectacular failures. They were the middle stratum of Americans, active in a huge range of activities, kind and generous and rather self-effacing, noisy and funny, politically neutral, tolerant of others' weirdness, remarkably accomplished. Almost all the girls, including Carla, played classical piano at an advanced level. Though most had been born and raised in the Northeast, in Connecticut, the majority had ended up living in the South. Almost everything that happened to members of the extended family was both typical of some larger trend and too individual or idiosyncratic to be dismissed as typical. Unlike Carla, not all of them looked Italian, though the girls all had their mother's huge Madonna eyes. You didn't have to scratch the surface much to find that their Italian mother and her ancient roots were what united them, held them together, made them survive as a family. It certainly wasn't Catholicism. The procreative progenitor raised them to be good Catholics, but the family Meisner denied the church success in the hidden agenda of its birth control policy: to populate the earth with Catholics. Only two practiced, one of whom tried hard to make up for all the rest, for a net generational gain of one. I loved that Carla was Italian, all Italian as far as I was concerned. I loved that she was smart and resourceful. I loved that she was young and beautiful. I loved that we shared ex-Catholicism. In short, I loved her. My first marriage was by now a completely dry well. Whole weeks went by when Judy and I didn't exchange more than 10 words, all of them polite. My elder daughter had left for Barnard. My younger would soon be off to Sarah Lawrence and spent as little time as possible at home. Our NoHo loft felt like an abandoned subway station through which the ghosts of long-dead commuters would sometimes drift, looking for things they had dropped in the 1920s. Judy's nose seemed to be getting rather large. Office affairs went against my grain. I'd been seriously burned at the Lampoon in an intramural fling and watched several other people turn brown and crispy. But one thing led to another, and when the Off the Wall Street Journal came out and was a hit, I had a funny, sexy lover to take to downtown parties, fly around the country with, and help me pop champagne from minibars in provincial presidential suites. Our first few months were a blur, but one moment stuck out. Judy and I had to spend a weekend in our country place in New Jersey to take care of some business. Though we hadn't split up yet, everything we did by now had an ominous finality, as if by unwritten consent we were wrapping things up. I'd promised to call Carla in the morning, but didn't feel right doing it from home. I drove down to the highway in a dreary little mall where there was a payphone. It was a rainy winter morning, outside a convenience store called Pop and Stop or Chicken Check or something. I called Carla, and after many rings, she answered. Her voice was very small and young and far away and slurry with sleep. A chilly spasm shook me from head to toe, a bit like the old elephant stepped on my grave feeling, but with far more foreboding, as if something seismic was happening to my life. Not necessarily pleasant, but impossible to avoid, ineluctably ordained. At the time, I put it down to adultery in New Jersey in the rain. It wasn't adultery in New Jersey in the rain. Fling turned into affair. I could deceive poor Judy no longer, came clean, and moved out. Affair became arrangement, as Carla and I passed beyond the first fine flush. We fit together in all kinds of ways, and were capable of major good times. In common, we had classical music, books, food and wine and cooking, old places and things, travel. I'd always been a European penny pincher, reluctant to splurge, fearful of debt. Carla was more American with money. She bought me stylish clothes and lavish presents, and made me travel to places I'd only dreamed of, like St. Bart's and Crete and Rio. She got a job, and began shooting up the corporate ladder. She revealed a brilliant flair for design and decoration, transforming the places we lived. My kids took to her, especially my younger and more volatile daughter, who called her the wicked stepmother. For her part, Carla, nearer in age to them than to me, who knew their music and could talk their language, acted as a kind of ambassador, allowing me to begin trying to repair some of the damage I'd done. But the more involved we became, the more often we fought. One reason, according to Carla, was that we shared an ingrained sense of inferiority and insecurity. She put it down to our shared Catholicism. A more immediate reason, I was not used to living with someone so emotional and intuitive. My habit was to provide reasoned explanations for my moods and behaviors to Judy, which she would accept as sincere and accurate, though we both knew they were hardly ever either. It wouldn't have been polite to challenge me. As for emotion, we barely remembered the meaning of the word. Carla couldn't have been more different. She had an uncanny way of sensing not just evasion, but any unaccustomed tick in my thought process. There was one enormous thing that I was holding back, rationalizing, paradoxically, that I didn't want to hurt her and lose her. I would not remarry. The clearer it got as 1 year became two and then three, that this was where things were headed, the harder it became to hide. I never really came out and said it. Foolishly, I said the opposite. Yes, of course I want to get married, just not yet. Let's wait till such and such is over. I'm sure she sussed that out as an evasion, but she didn't need to call me on it. I was out of the country often, and then all the time, with Spitting Image. I didn't confide to her my yearnings for the homeland any more than I did to my partners. The yearnings did not include marriage to her. Despite my fantasy of the English rose in green wellies, they didn't include marriage to anybody. I was in a bind. I'd said I would, but I knew I wouldn't. It wasn't that I wanted to play the field. There was no need. Nor did I have some pea-brained notion of freedom or independence, like some of my pals who'd broken up with their wives and now had younger girlfriends but wouldn't marry them. Who the hell wants independence as you approach the half-century? Only a hermit or a serial killer. Marriage became unthinkable after Spitting Image. I would not repeat any more mistakes. The eerie roadside frisson that had shaken me so, right at the beginning, became my rationale, a warning, a foretaste of more misery at my hands for yet another woman, this time one I loved. Carla was becoming more and more successful. She would be 30 in 1986, a woman who adored children, a born competitor whose siblings and in-laws were spitting out babies like buns from a bakery. Things came to a head. We'd gone for the weekend to Atlantic City. It was 1985. It seemed a very 80s thing to do. We had a great, silly time, as we always did when we were babes in the wood in this case being Trump's Taj Mahal. We laughed for hours, losing a couple of $100 in the process, and so to bed. Next morning, we awoke in high spirits and headed back to New York in a car she'd rented, chortling over the hideous denizens and torments of Donald's Pleasure Dome. As often happened, our high spirits turned dark and cancerous. By the time we hit the New Jersey Turnpike, we were in a fight as bad as any we'd ever had. It started with my nervousness at what I took to be her typically American driving style, tailgating the car in front while casually multitasking, looking for a map in the door pocket, fiddling with the radio, checking her makeup in the rearview mirror. This segued into, "It's my fucking car, I'll drive any way I fucking want." A sensitive point. I was in the middle of my book, and though the advance was okay, the initial chunk was gone. She was now, in effect, supporting me. Which in turn segued into, why wouldn't I agree to get married? Ever! I'd said we'd deal with it when the book was finished, the latest of many deadlines. She said she was calling me on this, right then and there. It's now or never! Say yes or it's all over! I can't go on like this! I yelled back, "That's ridiculous!" She screamed, "No, it's not!" and screeched to a halt on the median. Either you agree to marriage now, which you did years ago, by the way, or get out of my car. I'm not agreeing to marriage with a gun to my head. Then get the fuck out! We're in the middle of the fucking turnpike! She reached across me furiously and wrestled open the door. I didn't move. She shoved me hard, punched me a bit. I thought, what can she do if I get out? A standoff. She'll have to let me back in when the troopers show up. I got out. She took off up the median. I ran after her. She swerved into the roadway, nearly ending several marriages. Then she disappeared up the turnpike. I was dumbfounded. I had no money. It was my last $200 we'd lost. I was way down the turnpike in the Pine Barrens. It was Sunday morning. There were no cops, and no one in their right mind picks up hitchhikers from the turnpike median. What was I going to do? The big one began to sink in. She meant it. She was going to New York. She wasn't coming back. I'd lost her. She was a decisive corporate bigwig now, used to making up her mind and moving on. I was totally, totally fucked. I sat on the metal median divider, disconsolate. I couldn't go back to England. I had no money. It would be months before I even finished the book, let alone got the next advance. It was too late in the year to start a garden in New Jersey. How would I eat? How would I pay the mortgage? I'd have to sell. Jesus, I was going to be homeless. Hey, fuckhead! It was Carla, going about 3 miles an hour in the fast lane on the other side of the divider, cars blaring at her as they swerved desperately into the center lane. Changed your mind? Yeah. She speeded up, did a triple illegal U-turn at the end of the divider, and pulled up behind me, spraying dirt. I went over to the car to get in. The door was locked, but the window was down. Open the door. Not till you agree. Fuck, Carla. Bye, have a nice day. The car began to move. Wait. I leaned into the car. Will you marry me? Yes. She popped the lock. I got in. She screeched out onto the roadway at 70, checking her eyelashes in the rearview mirror. Carla, you're an asshole. But an effective asshole. And so, on the 20th day of September, in the year of our Lord 1986, in the 6th year of the reign of Ronaldus Caesar, a civil ceremony, not recognized by the church, was celebrated in the garden of my, soon to be our, New Jersey home. A gratifying number of people showed up, including several regiments of Carla's brothers and sisters. On a whim, I'd invited the only two lefties I knew anymore. One was Carl Bernstein, whom I'd always liked for two things. All the president's men, of course, but also his front-page lead in Not the New York Times, written in about 5 minutes after hearing of the death of John Paul I.